workers. No firm had been found at fault. Now, as Grace slept peacefully, others would take up her torch. Others would follow in her footsteps. Others would battle on as they continued the fight for recompense, for recognition, for justice. Part 3. Justice. 41. Ottawa, Illinois, 1933. The executives of the Radium Dial Company had confirmed knowledge of radium poisoning since at least 1925, less than 3 years after their studio first opened in Ottawa. That was the year Marguerite Carlo first filed suit in New Jersey, and Martland devised his tests. The executives had read CARES studies, attended the radium conference, and seen the Eben Byers story. They knew radium was dangerous. When their employees had found out about the New Jersey cases in 1928, the company had lied. There was a full-page advertisement in the paper. The girls are safe. Their medical exams prove it. The paint is safe, for it is pure radium only. When Peg Looney died, the company lied. There was no visible indication of radium poisoning. But only because her jawbone was no longer visible to anyone, having been cut from her after death. With these assurances plastered across the papers, the company had been supported by the town. After all, the executives had promised they would close the studio if there was any danger. No wonder the town was behind them when they took such good care of their employees and were willing to put people before profits. It must be really, really safe to work there, everyone thought. For 8 years on from Marguerite's lawsuit, Radium Dial was still trading daily in the little town of Ottawa. "Oh, no," the local doctor said. "It was definitely not radium poisoning that Catherine Wolfe Donahue had." She limped out of the consulting room, still no wiser as to the cause of her illness, and made her slow way home to East Superior Street. She was not alone. She pushed a stroller in which lay her baby son, Tommy, born in April 1933, just over a year after she'd married Tom Donahue. "God has sure blessed me," Catherine wrote, "with a grand husband and a lovely child." She and Tom had been married on January 23, 1932, in St. Columba. It was a modest wedding, with only 22 guests. Catherine's uncle and aunt had both passed away by then, and Tom's family did not approve of the union. As their niece, Mary, remembered it, none of Tom's family wanted him to marry her because they saw her as not being in good health. But Tom Donahue adored Catherine Wolfe, and it was a love match. He married her no matter what his relatives said. The Donahues seemed to have come around to the idea by the time the vows were exchanged. Tom's brother, Matthew, was the best man, while his twin sister Marie also attended. The local paper deemed it one of the prettiest weddings of the midwinter season. As Catherine had limped down the aisle to marry Tom, dressed in a green crepe gown and with a bouquet of tea roses clutched in her hands, she'd thought, despite her hobbling steps, that she had never felt so well, a feeling topped when they'd then been blessed with Tommy. If it wasn't for her declining health, she would be on top of the world. Today's appointment had been the third doctor she'd consulted, but he was as uninformative as the rest. "They were just guessing," commented one Dial painter's relative about the town's physicians. "They had no idea what the trouble was, especially any doctors in Ottawa." It was certainly true that the local physicians, perhaps as a result of the isolation of the tiny town, were not the most knowledgeable. Some of their cluelessness was apparently due to ignorance, despite the fact that by this time, Dr. Martland had published many articles on radium poisoning. As an example, one Ottawa doctor, a former physician of Peg Looney, as it happened, had recently stated, "It has never been brought to my attention that the use of luminous paint could, in any way, be responsible for the production of sarcoma." Whether it had been brought to their attention or not, Ottawa doctors were now seeing peculiar conditions in former radium dial girls. Sadie Prey had had a big black lump on her forehead. She'd died back in December 1931 of pneumonia, her death certificate said. Ruth Thompson had supposedly passed from tuberculosis. The doctors thought it a coincidence that the girls had all worked at Radium Dial, but nothing more than that. They had all died from different things, and their symptoms varied so much that surely there was no possible connection. Catherine pushed the stroller home dejectedly and let herself in the front door, 520 East Superior Street, which had been left to her by her uncle when he died in 1931, was a two-story detached white clapboard house with a pointed roof and a covered porch. It was on a quiet residential street. "It wasn't a big home," remembered Catherine's nephew James. "It had a galley kitchen and a modest dining room, where Tom would read books of an evening. This room was furnished by a blue couch and a round oak table. It was a perfect family house. We were so happy just staying home with Tommy," remembered Tom with a fond smile. As Catherine set Tommy down on a rug and watched him play, her mind went over her appointment. Mindful of the dial painter's deaths out east, she had asked the doctor today if radium poisoning could be what she had, but he'd said clearly that he didn't think so. He, like all the others, had repeatedly advised her he was not informed as to radium poisoning, thus to diagnose her case. Perhaps the doctors were influenced by what they'd read in the paper. No Ottawa girls could possibly have radium poisoning, for the paint Radium Dial used was not hazardous. Every time she went to church, Catherine was aware of the Radium Dial studio just across the road. It was a much quieter place these days. The economic downturn had the little town of Ottawa firmly in its grip. Tenaciously so, in fact, as Illinois was such a big farming state. Many dial painters had been laid off. Those who remained no longer lip-pointed, perhaps because of the Eben Byers case. Some were using their fingers instead. This doubled the amount of paint each woman handled. But given the financial hardships, the workers would paint any way they could. Those lucky enough to have a job were fiercely loyal to the firm. There was a feeling that the whole town needed to support such an employer. There were very few of them about in these straitened times. Though most of the original girls had been laid off or quit, their friendships had not faded. Catherine's close neighbors included Marie Rossiter and Charlotte Purcell. They often spent time together, and when they met, they talked. They talked of Catherine's tender jaw, of Charlotte's achy elbow, of Marie's sore legs. Marie and Charlotte had also gone to various doctors, and as the women discussed what the different physicians had said, they realized they'd all had the same response. And it wasn't just them. Marie Robinson's mother said the doctors scoffed when she mentioned radium poisoning as a possible cause of her daughter's disease. As had happened in Orange, mysterious illnesses were plaguing the girls of Ottawa. But here there was no Dr. Martland making pioneering medical discoveries, not even a Dr. Barry, who was familiar with Fossey Jaw. The conditions the girls were experiencing were completely novel in this town. Although there had been that visit from the national investigator Swen Kerr. He had visited the local dentists and doctors, and he had visited not once, but twice. He had told them what he was looking for, described the telltale signs of radium poisoning. Yet the doctors do not seem to have connected the dots, nor notified the Bureau of Labor Statistics of these curious cases, as they had once promised to do. An oversight? Or was it, as some of the women were now starting to fear, that none of the local physicians will admit it? One Dial Painter's relative thought so. They didn't want anything to happen to the company, he said. They were all bought off, claimed another. It was confusing, remembered Catherine's niece, Mary. I remember that no one seemed to know what was wrong, but we knew something was wrong, really wrong. 42. Charlotte Purcell heaved the bags of groceries into her arms and set off home. She was already thinking of how many meals she could eke from the food she'd bought. Times were tough, and everybody was tightening their belts. The newspapers were full of more bad news in that February of 1934. The country was experiencing the worst ever drought in its history. For Charlotte and Al, who now had three kids to feed, it was a precarious situation. Charlotte paused on her way home to rest, rubbing cautiously at her left arm. It had begun to bother her last year, but now there was a continuous, achy pain. The local doctors told her to use hot towels, recalled her husband, Al. Hot towels, however, had had zero effect. Charlotte concentrated on her fingertips, running them gently over her arm. Yes, she thought, it was definitely bigger. She peered closely at the little swelling nestled in the crook of her elbow. It was just a little bump, but it seemed to her it was growing larger. She would show it to Al later, she thought, see what he had to say. Suddenly, Charlotte cried out in pain. The bag in her left arm dropped fast to the floor, spewing groceries onto the sidewalk. She had felt a sharp, knife-like pain which went through the elbow. She bit her lip, rubbing again at where the pain was, and then bent to clear up her shopping. This was happening more and more frequently, when holding something it would drop out of her hands. It was the last thing she needed. The kids were 4, 3, and a year and a half old. She needed to get well. Maybe prayer would help. That Sunday, she slid into her pew at St. Columba with her usual piousness and bent her head to pray. There was a bit of a commotion further ahead, and Charlotte glanced up to see Catherine struggling. At that time, her friend's legs had been stiffening, so she had trouble kneeling in church. Catherine could barely bend her legs on the solid wooden plank in the pews. Tom had his arms around her, trying to help her. He looked alarmed at his wife's condition. In fact, Tom found himself in a frenzy of anxiety. Catherine was still just about able to kneel and get around, but some days it was a close-run thing. She kept saying that they didn't have the money to get better medical care, but Tom now decided something had to be done. Catherine owned their house outright, after all. They could always mortgage it. That would free up some cash for doctor's bills. Tom helped his wife slowly back to her feet. She was panting from the effort, blowing out little pained breaths as she tried to force her limbs to straighten. Yes, this had gone on too long. If the doctors in Ottawa wouldn't help, Tom was determined to find somebody who would. He went to Chicago, the nearest city. It was 85 miles away, but Tom traveled 85 miles there and 85 miles back. And he brought a doctor back with him, Charles Loeffler. A reputable medical man and blood specialist, Loeffler was kindly-looking with sticky-out ears. He first saw Catherine at the Ottawa office where she worked on March 10, 1934. Despite his experience, he was initially flummoxed by her symptoms, but adamant he would learn the cause. He took a blood specimen and, on testing it in Chicago, noticed a toxic quality in her blood. The following Saturday, he returned to Ottawa and found Catherine had declined significantly in the intervening week. She became so ill that just at the time her doctor's bills soared, Loeffler's invoice by the end of it would be for some $605, $10,701, she was forced to leave work. Loeffler did what he could to alleviate her anemia and increasing pain, while he continued to hunt for a diagnosis. The lump in Charlotte Purcell's elbow, meanwhile, had now swollen to the size of a golf ball. She had terrible pain all down her arm. It was worse at night, when she'd lie awake, scared and confused. She and Al also went to Chicago, like their neighbor Tom Donahue, but found 15 Chicago specialists were puzzled by her case. Catherine told her friend about Dr. Loeffler, so the next time he was in Ottawa, Charlotte also went to him for treatment, and it seems she persuaded many of her former colleagues to do the same. "She got them together," remarked a relative. "She was kind of pushy about it." The girls had been a clique at work, and those who were left alive had not forgotten the bonds of their sisterhood. In the end, Loeffler hosted several informal clinics for the women at a local hotel. Helen Munk attended, no longer married because, she said, her husband had divorced her because of her illness. She confessed her legs felt hollow, as if air was rushing through. Though she was a woman who wanted to be going all the time, she said miserably, "Now I have to be quiet. Still, I never wanted to be quiet." Olive West Witt, a dark-haired, motherly woman, was distraught. "I'll tell you how I feel," she said. "I'm just 36, but I live like an old woman of 75. Inez Vallet also hobbled to the hotel. Since last February, one side of her face had drained constantly with pus, while her hips were now so locked that she was almost at the point that she could move neither backward nor forward. Marie Rossiter told the doctors how she would love to dance, but I can't because of my ankles and the bones of my legs. Charlotte persuaded the Glachinsky sisters, Frances and Marguerite, to come too. "Charlotte never felt sorry for herself," said a relative. "She would just take over and take care of everyone." Though Loeffler traveled to Ottawa every weekend throughout March and into April 1934, he was still not ready to present a diagnosis. Come April 10th, Charlotte could wait no longer. The growing mass in her arm was excruciating. "We finally took her to Chicago to Dr. Marshall Davison," her husband Al remembered. It was there, at the Cook County Hospital, that Dr. Davison presented Charlotte with a choice. In order to live, he told her, there was only one option. He would have to amputate her arm. Charlotte was 28 years old. She had three children under five. Yet what choice did she have? She chose life. They cut off her arm at the shoulder. There was no way, a relative later said, that they could use a prosthetic arm or a hook because they had nothing to attach it to. It was gone. Her limb, which had always been there, scratching her nose, carrying shopping, holding a watch dial, was gone. The doctors were mystified by the arm itself. With all the grim fascination of medics, after the operation, they kept it in formaldehyde because it was so odd. For the Purcells, there was simply a strange relief. "Dr. Davison says we're lucky to have her still with us," Al Purcell said quietly. But his wife had been left helpless. Before the operation, she had slid from her left hand, for the last time, her wedding ring. Now she wore it on her right hand, and asked Al to safety pin her left sleeve to cover up the missing limb. "My husband," she later said, "is my hands." Charlotte and Al only hoped that such a huge sacrifice would be enough. But already it didn't help with one thing. "She still feels," Al remarked, "the terrible pain of the hand and arm they removed." The ghost girl had phantom pains from the limb that was no longer there. "There is some possibility," Al added, "of recurrence on the right side. We're not sure yet." Only time would tell. 43. It arrived by letter at 520 East Superior Street, a slim, unremarkable envelope addressed to Mr. Thomas Donahue. It looked innocent enough, but the news it held was anything but. Having run his tests, including X-rays on her jaw, Dr. Loeffler could now confirm it. Catherine Donahue was suffering from radium poisoning. "Tom was devastated," remembered his niece, Mary. "Just absolutely devastated. I don't know how the man functioned." "After that," Tom himself said, "I took care of Tommy when Catherine could not do so." Catherine herself never spoke publicly about how she felt. She probably prayed, as did many of her fellow sufferers. "I firmly believe," wrote one of her friends, "that prayers is all that brought me through." Yet just days after Catherine and Tom had received that letter from Chicago, Catherine's disease took even the solace of prayer away from her. On Wednesday, April 25th, 1934, she hobbled the short distance to St. Columba, but found herself unable to kneel in church. Her hips had become so locked that she could no longer bend her legs to pray. For Catherine, so devout, it was profoundly distressing. At about the same time, Charlotte Purcell came home from the hospital for the first time with her arm off. The doctors had confirmed radium was to blame for all of this, and Tom Donahue felt somebody should tell Radium Dial. Ottawa was a small place. Mr. and Mrs. Reed, the firm's superintendent and instructress, didn't attend St. Columba, but they were forever walking past it as they went to work. "I saw him on the street," remembered Tom of running into Reed. "I told him the women were in a bad way, and that the doctors were finding it was from the material in the paints they were using." But Mr. Reed refused to admit any responsibility. He refused, even after he saw Charlotte and her husband walking past the studio, where they met him coming down the steps. Al was very angry at what had happened, but Mr. Reed brushed off everything they said. Dr. Loeffler tried to communicate with the firm, too. Going above Mr. Reed's head, he telephoned Vice President Fordyce. I told him from the cases I had seen, I thought it would be wise to investigate all the other cases. Loeffler's phone call was not unexpected to Rufus Fordyce. After all, the firm had in its possession the results of the radioactivity tests of all the women at Radium Dial, taken back in 1928. The results that showed that, of the 67 girls tested that day, 34 were suspiciously or positively radioactive. 34 women. More than half the workforce. The company had said in its press statement at the time, "Nothing even approaching symptoms of radium poisoning has ever been found." That declaration was not some miscalculation caused by a misunderstanding of the data. The data was clear. Most of the employees were radioactive, a telltale sign of radium poisoning. But though the women's breath betrayed the truth, the company had deliberately and unashamedly lied. The company still had the women's names on its secret list of results, each numbered according to how radioactive she was. Ranked at number 1 for positivity, Margaret Looney, Mary Tonielli, Marie Rossiter. Very suspicious were the results of Catherine Wolfe and Helen Munk. For almost 6 years, Radium Dial had known the women were radioactive. Yet, the knowledge of the discoveries had been carefully concealed by the firm, who feared disruption of their business if the facts became known. The victims had not been informed of their condition, nor the cause, through fear of panic among the workers. It all meant that when Loeffler's call came in, Fordyce was ready. He refused to do anything. Catherine, Charlotte, and all the other girls, however, were determined to make the company pay. In many ways, they had no choice. Catherine had already expended large sums in a vain effort to be cured of the disease, and she and Tom were stone broke. It was Loeffler who helped the women take the next step, connecting them with an acquaintance of his, the stenographer of a Chicago lawyer, J. Cook. Cook was formerly with the Illinois Industrial Commission, which oversaw all industrial compensation cases, and he agreed to represent them virtually on charity. Though the women never met him, he, nevertheless, gave advice from the big city. Like so many New Jersey lawyers before him, he saw at once that the women's case was complex and that an early settlement might be to their advantage. The girls told him there were rumors that their former colleague Mary Robinson might have been given some compensation after she'd had her arm amputated at the start of the year. The Dial people gave her some money, Mary's mother confirmed. They sent it to her husband, Francis. Not very much, probably not over $100, $1,768, altogether. It may not have been much, but it was an open door through which the other women hoped to find some financial aid. There was another reason to approach the company, the statute of limitations. Under Illinois law, at the earliest instance of diagnosis, the women had to give Radium Dial notice of their condition. Such notification should then lead the company to act lawfully in providing medical care and compensation, since the women had been injured at work. It was Charlotte and Catherine, as they had done from the start, who led the way. They only hoped that the company would now be fair. With the help of J. Cook, and working with their husbands, the women came up with a plan. Catherine wrote a letter on behalf of them all on May 1, 1934, and then Al Purcell telephoned the studio so that Catherine could read it down the line to the manager. Immediately afterwards, Tom took the hard copy and ran it down the street to the mailbox. The company had been given their notification. Now, the women only had to wait. They waited, and waited, and waited. By May 8th, there had been no reply. Not one word. On the advice of Cook, the women now took matters into their own hands and headed back to Radium Dial to confront their old manager, Mr. Reed. It was a journey Catherine had undertaken so many times before. Turn right out of the house, walk straight to Columbus Street, turn left and walk one block to Radium Dial. But it had never been a journey like this before. She felt nervous, but knew she had to stand up for herself and for all the other girls. They had agreed that she and Charlotte would be spokesmen for the other women. Charlotte walked slowly by her side, keeping pace with Catherine's limp. It felt so strange walking, Charlotte thought. She had never realized before how much you used your arms when you walked. Now there was nothing but air by her side. Charlotte was a woman who didn't dwell on herself. She never felt sorry for herself, ever, said a relative, though she had said after her amputation, "I can't do housework." Already she was finding ways to cope. She had managed to open and close her baby's diaper pins with her mouth. Washing up the frying pan, she had discovered, could be achieved if she set the handle under her chin. It was Al, of course, who picked up the rest of the slack. But Al wasn't here now. It was just the two of them, Catherine and Charlotte. The women walked along, so different from how they'd been when they'd first entered the studio. Catherine hobbled up the 6 front steps and tried to straighten up as much as she could. They made their way inside and found Mr. Reed. "I have received a letter from my doctor who has been treating me for weeks," Catherine said formally to him. She had a cultured voice, and her words were sure. "He has come to the definite conclusion that my blood shows radioactive substance." She gestured at Charlotte to include her. "We have radium poisoning." There it was. Fact. Hard to say out loud, but fact. She paused to see if there was a reaction, but there was nothing from the man who had been her manager for 9 years. Having consulted legal advice, Catherine went on, in spite of Mr. Reed's silence, "My lawyers have advised me to ask the company for compensation and medical care. We have legal advice that we are entitled to compensation." Mr. Reed looked over his former employees. Catherine had barely been able to get into the studio. Charlotte no longer had an arm. "I don't think," he said slowly, "there is anything wrong with you." The women were gobsmacked. "There is nothing to it at all," he said again. "He refused," Catherine remembered angrily, "to consider our request for compensation." She notified him about the condition of the other women, too, but he didn't back down. He didn't back down even when, 2 days later, Mary Robinson died. Her death was important. Mary's was the first case definitely called radium poisoning, her mother Susie recalled. Her doctor sent a sliver of bone to a New York laboratory. They sent back word it was radium poisoning. The Ottawa doctors couldn't deny it then. But Susie had reckoned without the stubbornness of the Ottawa physicians. just because these hoity-toity New York and Chicago folk were saying Ottawa girls had radium poisoning, it didn't make it true, not in their eyes. The Ottawa doctors remained skeptical and steadfastly refused to admit that radium poisoning was the cause of the women's illnesses and deaths. When Mary's death certificate was signed, the attending doctor answered no to the question, was disease in any way related to occupation of deceased? But although the local doctors were not convinced, the women absolutely were. In light of the company's refusal to aid them, in the summer of 1934, a large group of dial painters, including Catherine, Charlotte, Marie, and Inez Vallet, filed suit for $50,000, $884,391, apiece. Jay Cook thought they stood a good chance of winning. Illinois law was progressive, and a pioneering act passed in 1911 had long commanded companies to protect their employees. But not everyone was pleased with the possibility of bringing the firm to its knees. The town bitterly resented these women's charges as giving a black eye to the community. Ottawa was a close-knit and folksy town, but the girls soon realized that when it turned against you, it turned hard. "They weren't treated too nice," commented a relative of Marie with understatement. After all, Radium Dial had long been a valued employer. With the country in the middle of its worst ever economic depression, what some were now calling the Great Depression, communities were even more protective of the firms that could give them work and wages. The women found they were disbelieved, ignored, and even shunned when they spoke out about their ailments and the cause. Day after day, former colleagues and friends lined up to dismiss them. Margaret Looney was one of the girls that appeared to me to look as if she had one foot in the grave when she was hired, exclaimed one radium dial worker bluntly. The girls that people thought died from radium and looked terrible when they were hired. Some of them shun us as if we had the plague, remarked Catherine's friend Olive Witt. Catherine lived just a few paces from Division Street in Ottawa, and it was painfully apt, given the way the women had split the town, and the disapproval went right to the top, with business interests, politicians, and the clergy all against the women bringing suit. In her little house on East Superior, however, Catherine ignored everything that was going on in the outside world. Her world, now, reduced down. Down to the four walls of the clapboard house. Down to the room she was standing in. Down to the dress hanging on her body. Down to her body itself. She stood quite still, as though listening. Then she felt it again. She recognized that feeling. She knew what that was. Catherine Wolfe Donahue was pregnant. 44. Catherine's treatment from Dr. Loeffler stopped immediately. There would be no more injections for her severe anemia, and no more pain-killing sedatives. They might hurt the baby. There was absolutely no question of a termination. Catherine and Tom were devout Catholics and would never have considered it. This child was a blessing from God. Catherine continued to consult Loeffler, however. He was the only physician she could trust. He was very expensive, though. The mounting doctor's bills became too much for her husband, though Tom tried not to let that show. As people in the local area surrounding Ottawa came to learn of the dial painter's lawsuit, censure of their actions heightened. Yet for every citizen disapproving of the news, There were women for whom the gossip brought the most enormous sense of relief, for it provided a solution to a long, unanswered question. "It came to my attention," wrote Pearl Payne, "that girls who had formerly worked at the radium dial were dying prematurely and of mysterious causes. I began to put two and two together. I then came to the conclusion that I had radium poisoning." Pearl had dial painted for only 8 months in the early 1920s. She didn't live in Ottawa, but LaSalle, some 13 miles down the road, a fair distance if you didn't have a car, which most people did not in the 1930s. Pearl had left Radium Dial to nurse her mother, and then focused on having a large family with her husband, Hobart. She'd been thrilled when they'd had their first child, Pearl Charlotte, in 1928. But to Pearl's despair, it had all gone wrong the following year. She began staggering when she walked, and was sick throughout 1929. In 1930, she underwent an abdominal operation to remove a tumor. Afterwards, her head swelled to twice its normal size, and it did not go down. "There were big black knots behind her ears," recalled her husband. A specialist was summoned. He cut Pearl's ears inside and out for drainage. The cuts had to be opened up every few days, though it eventually reduced the swelling, said Pearl. "One side of my face was paralyzed." In time, this paralysis left her, but then another problem began. Pearl started bleeding continuously down below. Another tumor was removed and a curettment of the womb performed, which meant a scraping out of tissue. Yet it didn't help. The next time she bled for 87 days straight. During this time, she remembered, the doctor was perplexed and said, "I must have had a miscarriage." He persisted in this argument as Pearl, again and again, bled and endured yet another curettment. "I knew this was not so," Pearl cried in frustration at the doctor's diagnosis, "because nothing had been done to cause me to be pregnant." Instead, the problem seemed to be the tumors growing inside her, growing where her children should have been. Her condition was serious. She endured 5 years of continual doctoring, 6 operations, and 9 trips in all to the hospital. At one stage, she had been moved to write to Hobart from her deathbed, believing the end was near. "Dearest sweetheart," she wrote, "I love you, and am laying here thinking of you, and wishing I was in your dear arms. I am afraid I was very impatient with you for some time, and I am heartily sorry. Please forgive me, as I have been very nervous and ill for a long time. Beneath it all, I have loved you very deeply and dearly. Pray for me daily that I may get well perfectly. If not, do not grieve, as we must bow our heads to the Lord's will. Be good to our baby girl. Teach her to love and remember me, and above all to be a good, virtuous girl. Tell her I loved her dearly." The emotional pressure was unbearable. Pearl never knew if today would be her last. In time, her sickness affected both her body and her mind. "I am unable to enjoy life as a normal woman should," she wrote dully. The doctors told her she belonged to a class of women in which the medical profession does not know the reason for their illness. She was treated for malaria, anemia, and other conditions, The doctor's guesses were especially frustrating for Pearl because she had been trained as a nurse. She knew none of the theories were right, but she was at a loss as to what could be the true cause. By the April of 1933, Pearl had become desperate. "I notified my doctor of more bleeding," she remembered, "and he advised the removal of the uterus. I refused, and lay in bed for several days debating what to do. A hysterectomy. It would mean the end of her dreams for more children. No," she thought, "no, not yet. She needed more time, more hope." She called in other doctors, had other treatment, hoping for a different outcome, but it was all to no avail. In July 1933, she wrote numbly, "I was completely sterilized." Pearl was heartbroken. "I was attacked by severe heart and sinking spells," she recalled. As she read of the radium poisoning cases in Ottawa, she grasped that her devastating condition might prove fatal, but at least she had an explanation. "I believed," she wrote of her case, "that radium had attached to the tissue of certain organs, causing them to be destroyed through tumorous growth." She decided to get in touch with her old friend, Catherine Donahue. The two women, who were very similar in nature, now became extremely close. Not long after, Pearl joined the fight for justice. The lawsuit was gaining momentum. The women were gaining friends. In Chicago, however, Joseph Kelly, president of Radium Dial, was finding the opposite. By October 1934, perhaps in light of the lawsuits, he had clean run out of friends in his company. An executive called William Ganley wrested control of Radium Dial, and Kelly and his associates were voted out. "There were very hard feelings," recalled one company officer, "because of the corporate shenanigans that went on." But, Kelly had decided, he was not finished with Ottawa. Every current dial painter at Radium Dial now received a letter. Mr. Turner, a manager at the plant under Mr. Reed, invited them all to a restaurant where they were fed while he talked to them. He had an announcement. A new dial painting business was going to be opening in town, and he had a question. "How about you highly skilled girls join us at Luminous Processes?" It seems the women weren't told it would be run by Joseph Kelly and Rufus Fordyce, who'd had charge of Radium Dial during the radium poisoning scandal. They were told something extraordinary, though. Mr. Turner informed them that earlier dial painters had died because they put brushes in their mouths, and since brush licking was no longer permitted, exposure to radium would not be harmful. It was an admission of guilt, but the original dial painters never got to hear of it. The new studio opened just a few blocks over from Radium Dial in a two-story red brick warehouse. Thanks to the clandestine meeting in the restaurant, most of the dial painters moved across, thinking the new operation safe. They applied paint using handheld sponges and wooden spatulas, using fingers to smooth it over, and wore thin cotton smocks to give them some protection from the dust. Not every worker went, however. Mr. Reed stayed on as superintendent of the old firm. Loyal to the end, he and Mrs. Reed stuck with the company that had made them. They faced a fiercely competitive situation, for Radium Dial now competed directly with Joseph Kelly's new business in the same small town. Just down the road from this battle of big business, however, Catherine Donahue cared not a jot for the corporate infighting going on that fall. All that mattered to her was the tiny little girl she was cradling in her arms. She and Tom named their daughter Mary Jane, after Tom's mother. "We always called her Mary Jane," remarked her cousin. "Never Mary, just Mary Jane." Catherine Donahue vowed that she would make her daughter proud. 45. As 1935 began, Jay Cook was busy working on the women's lawsuit. He filed two separate claims for them, one in the normal law courts and a second with the Illinois Industrial Commission. The lead case, Cook determined, would be that of Inez Vallett. "She was a living corpse," Catherine said of her former deskmate, "hobbling around like an old woman." But as the case got going, almost immediately the women ran into trouble. Radium Dial was being represented by a team of top lawyers who found several legal loopholes through which they twisted the case. There was that old chestnut, the statute of limitations. Inez had filed suit years after she left Radium Dial, and her disability did not occur while she was employed. There was the fact that radium was a poison. Injuries caused by poison were not covered by the Occupational Diseases Act. And there was the law itself. Radium Dial charged that its antiquated wording was vague, indefinite, and did not furnish an intelligible standard of conduct. When Attorney Cook filed his test case, the Chicago Daily Times later wrote, Radium Dial did not even bother to deny the women's charges. In effect, the company's reply was, "Even if it is true, what of it?" On April 17, 1935, a ruling was given. The court ruled the legislature failed to establish any standards by which compliance with the law could be measured, reported the Ottawa Daily Times. The women had lost on a legal technicality. They could not believe it, yet they fought on. Cook, at his own expense, took the battle all the way to the Supreme Court. Yet it was all to no avail. The law was declared invalid. The Chicago Daily Times called it an almost unbelievable miscarriage of justice. But there was nothing the women could do. They'd had their day in court, and the law itself had been found wanting. There was never a trial of this case on its merits, lamented the newspaper. Cook, reluctantly, had to drop their case, even though the girls still had a claim filed with the IIC, and legislators now vowed to rewrite the law in light of the women's case. I hated to have to do it, but I simply couldn't afford to keep on, Cook later said. If I had the money, I'd fight their case free. It's one of those things that should be fought through to a finish. I hope they get another lawyer. But finding another lawyer was easier said than done. There were 41 attorneys listed in the Ottawa Town Directory, but not one would help them. Just as the native physicians had done, the legal profession was shutting down what was seen as a scandalous attack on a loyal local business. As if to rub it in, on the day the Ottawa paper reported the loss of the women's case, it featured an article on Clarence Darrow, one of the nation's leading lawyers. That was the kind of person the girls needed, but they had no money to secure legal aid. The Donahues now found the mortgage on their house had crept to $1,500, $25,000. There are medicines that ease the pain, Catherine said, and on these she and Tom were spending hundreds of dollars. They found themselves playing make-believe, trying to ignore what was happening to their family of four. "We never talk about it," confessed Tom. "We just go along as if we were all going to be together forever. That's the only way." "We're so happy together," Catherine said with a too big smile. As long as we're together, it doesn't seem so bad. We just pretend I'm the way I was when Tom married me. They hadn't given up looking for a cure. Catherine found herself trying various Chicago hospitals and dentists, pushing herself to get to the appointments, even though she frequently fainted during the course of the examinations due to the pain. She was looking for help, a commentator said, any way she could get it. But no one could stop the disintegration of Catherine's mouth, which grew more serious by the day. The women struggled on, downcast about the devastating loss of their court case, in denial about the looming demise that seemed inevitable. And then, just at the end of the year, word of another legal judgment reached them. It didn't necessarily affect their case, but it was of considerable interest nonetheless. On December 17, 1935, the ruling finally came back on the Irene Laporte case in New Jersey, which her husband Vincent had been fighting for more than 4 years. This was the case the United States Radium Corporation had chosen to see through to judgment, the one on which they had placed their bets. The company, by now, did not deny the cause of death. It simply cited the statute of limitations as the reason why it should not have to pay. Once Irene's employment was terminated, the USRC lawyers stated, all duty we had to that girl as our employee ceased. There is no relation afterwards. She is a perfect stranger. Several dial painters testified at the trial. Many had their own lawsuits pending. All pinned their hopes on Irene winning her case, for if she did, the verdict would apply to them, too. Everyone gathered to hear the judgment. The judge began, "Naturally, there is no question as to where the sympathies of any human being would lie in a case of this sort. It is tempting, in the light of the knowledge of today, to create the thought that the company must have been negligent in some way. Today, industrial methods which the company then employed would not be merely negligent, but criminal. But it should be carefully noted that this case must be decided on the facts as they existed in the light of the knowledge of 1917. A court has no power to adjust the law to meet the needs of a time when no such case as this could be foreseen. He concluded bluntly, "The case must be dismissed." USRC had chosen well. 7 years on from Grace Fryer's case, there was now no censure in the media, no censure even from the judge. The company had the answer it was looking for. Not guilty. Justice had been denied to Irene Laporte, but not just to her. For all those New Jersey dial painters with lawsuits still pending, for all the families battling on for loved ones who had died, for all those New Jersey women who had not yet found a worrying lump on their hip or their leg or their arm, but who would in future. Justice was denied. It had been, the USRC executives reflected, a very good day indeed. 46. You fight, and you fall, and you get up and fight some more. But there will always come a day when you cannot fight another minute more. On February 25, 1936, Inez Vallet died. She was 29. After 8 years of agony, she finally succumbed to a hemorrhage from sarcoma of the neck, bleeding out as medics desperately tried to staunch the flow of blood. Mr. Vallet, dial painter Francis O'Connell recalled, would not talk at all about his wife, because she had died a very horrible death, and he did not want to think about it or talk about it. The Ottawa doctors completed her death certificate. Was death in any way related to occupation of deceased? No. Inez's death, coming on top of the lawsuit defeat, left the Ottawa women reeling. Many of the original clique were too ill to attend her funeral, as much as they wanted to say goodbye.